5 p.m. on Wednesday. Feels like Friday, though. Feels like this week has been already like 7 days long. But I'm glad it is hump day. So I'm halfway there anyway, everybody. This is Tom Ryan with me, my lovely wife and co-host and engineer as well. Heidi Morales Ryan. We're going to be with you for the next hour as we do what we always do on Wednesday. One of two things, basically, usually anyway. We are either looking at an album, which we call the Alternative Top 40, a list of 500 albums that never made the top 40, or we are looking at 500 albums that did make the top 40, which we are calling the top 500 of the top 40.
We finally evened out, right?
Well, we finally caught up.
That's what I mean.
We left off with the alternative top 40 thing in June of 1968. So we are now moving into July 68. And we've had three albums, actually. We covered them in the past 3 weeks. Well, the past three shows that we covered albums. A couple of weeks back, we covered Wheels of Fire by Cream. That was a July 1968 album that went to number one. That was followed by last week, when we also covered from July of 1968, the Moody Blues' In Search of the Lost Chord, which went to number 23. And now, this is album number 60 in the series that we call Top 500 of the Top 40, also released in July of 1968. Not as high as the two other albums on the charts that preceded it, but I would say easily the winner in terms of the classic connotation. We are talking about, it only went to number 30, but I think most everybody would concede that Music from Big Pink by the band is one of the most classic albums. It's about as classic as an album can get. Now, as I said, though, it did chart on the top 40, but it didn't chart especially high. Number 30, still obviously respectable. But when Music from Big Pink was released, very few people had any knowledge of the band. Up until this point, their only real claim to fame was a stint as the backing band for Ronnie Hawkins, where they played mostly on the Southern Chitlin' circuit and stuff, doing shows in the South.
A lot of people loved Ronnie Hawkins. I'm just going to go out there and say that.
Definitely, but he was not a national superstar. He wasn't even really a national star. He was
right.
a regional almost star.
Yeah.
You know? And, of course, the members of, you know, which they didn't have, at that time they were called the Hawks, Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks. And it was, you know, these four Canadian guys that loved to, you know, they just loved the fact that they were in the South. They were learning and paying attention and picking up ideas and culture and absorbing it like a sponge because it was new to them. It fascinated them. The only person in the band who was from that area who basically was showing the rest of the guys around was Levon Helm. So that's where that reputation really more or less began to develop and where that came from. So they start as with this a stint as the backing band for Ronnie Hawkins. And then after that, they followed it with a shorter and much more volatile stint as Bob Dylan's backup during his infamous First Electric tour. Now, that was them, with the exception of Levon, who couldn't stand getting booed at every night. And he said, I'm not doing this. So he pulled himself off of that tour while the others stuck it out with Bob. Now, neither of these two situations with the Hawks, you know, with Ronnie Hawkins or with Bob Dylan, exactly ingratiated the band to rock or folk audiences. In fact, they were probably looked as bad guys by a lot of the folk audiences. But by 1968, the tide started to turn their way. First thing that they did was that they moved into the Woodstock area in upstate New York, a town called East Saugerties, actually, to be specific, where a reclusive Bob Dylan was living and woodshedding with a few new ideas. He had stopped playing music after Blonde on Blonde in 1966, and you hadn't heard us cover anything from him until we hit John Wesley Harding recently on another show. And when that album came out, all of a sudden there was a renewed interest in, of course, there was always an interest in what Dylan was doing, especially in his absence. Well, what was happening was these guys were playing with him. That's what, well, Bob's woodshedding his ideas. All this also coincided with a subtle but significant change in popular taste. Now, obviously, 1967, psychedelic styles were huge. Look at Sgt. Pepper. But here it is a year later, and it seemed that psychedelic styles had begun to like run their course and slowly gave way to a much more organic approach to music. And basically, you could say that the flower power movement had morphed into a more holistic approach to rebellion, where the youth movement felt the need to get back to the earth. Now, the band were about as close to the earth as a band could get. Even their simplistic name, chosen because that is simply how the audience referred to them when they were on the Dylan tour, signified a move away from extravagance. In 1968, Dylan's basement sessions were quickly becoming the world's worst kept secret, and a brand new bootleg industry was developing solely around the band's recordings with Dylan in East Saugerties. The musicians had become legendary, even though nobody really knew much about them at all. That all changed with the release of Music from Big Pink. It's their debut album, and it takes its name from the house where the band lived, most of them, and where the basement tapes were being recorded. A new legend was about to begin, with the band suddenly wielding about as much influence on the state of popular music as the Beatles. The times certainly were a-changin'. The first track on the album is a song that's co-written by Bob Dylan and Richard Manuel of the band. First thing you're going to hear is Robbie Robertson's guitar being fed through a Leslie speaker to get that sort of sad crying sound. And it's just an incredibly intense song, a song that, at least on its surface, is very similar, since we're speaking about parallels of psychedelic and earthy. Think of She's Leaving Home off of the Beatles, about a girl, you know, leaving her parents. This song covers a similar topic from the parents' perspective. Now, you could read it literally as an extension of that, or you could also see it as being a commentary on the times and how different ways of life were being abandoned. Either way, you know, with Richard Manuel's like keening voice, it was a rather auspicious beginning, I should say, to an album with a song that was this direct and sad, and written by Bob Dylan and Richard Manuel together. Here's Tears of Rage.
Now you
opening track from Music from Big Pink. This album for the band signified their first step away from the incredibly long shadow that was cast by Bob Dylan. And it was a tentative one at that, actually, since Dylan was responsible for all the lyrics on the opening track. Manuel wrote the music, but it was Dylan who provided the words. Now, what they really had to do was establish themselves as independent so that they didn't necessarily need Dylan. So the members themselves, of course, did write most of the songs on the album, although Dylan appears as a co-writer or exclusive writer on three of them. Now, we have come to basically realize that Robbie Robertson is the band's primary songwriter. On this album, though, it's amazing. On the debut album, he has pretty good competition from the bass player, Richard Manuel, excuse me, the keyboard player, Richard Manuel, who actually, as I said, besides writing the opening track, wrote 1, 2, 3 other tracks on the album. So between Robertson and Manuel, they're basically sharing responsibility for providing material. We can compare them here on these next two tracks side by side. The first song is a Robbie Robertson song called To Kingdom Come, and we'll follow that with a Richard Manuel song called In a Station.
Somebody's gonna lose. In a
And we're just getting started on an album that is, I can say, almost stunningly classic in its effect that it had. I mean, everybody from like Eric Clapton, they just heard this album and they were basically like stopped in their tracks. It was time to rethink. Richard Thompson, even, of course, with the whole English folk movement, was floored by all of this, what was coming on in America, because all of a sudden, here, I guess, it was this organic sound. It wasn't about crazy psychedelic, you know, like drug-influenced music. It was the exact opposite. It sounded like farmers who were recording songs. And just it added a huge depth to rock and roll, something that it really didn't have before. It was a new element at the time. And right there, we get a bit of a comparison in the two major songwriters on the first album. The first track, To Kingdom Come, said Robbie Robertson's song, and that was followed by Richard Manuel singing In a Station. Now, most of the album was recorded in Manhattan at A&R Studios on 52nd Street in early 1968. But the band had written just about everything and made, you know, their own recordings and such when they were living at Big Pink, up near Woodstock.
East Socrates,
right. So when they, you know, they had all their material set when they came to New York, but, you know, when they met their producer, who basically was talking to them, I think it's John Simon. Yes, John Simon was asking them, like, okay, well, what can we do with this? What are you hoping to accomplish with the sound? And they pretty much just said, we want it to sound just like it did in the basement. Like, don't mess with it. Leave it alone. Well, they recorded most of the album at A&R, but they also ended up moving, you know, after they got signed on Capitol Records. Capitol had a recording studio in on the West Coast, so they cut in a couple of studios in California as well. In fact, both of the songs that we just heard were recorded in California, In a Station and To Kingdom Come, both recorded there. But let's pick up then, and let's get another taste of what Robbie Robertson's songwriting was like in the very beginning, this early in his career. The next track on the album is entitled Caledonia Mission.
She reads the leaves, and she leads the life that she learned so. Change it, but hear me if you're near.
A slight apology on my part for the miscue. I didn't mean to cue up the live version, but that is a great version of the song. I meant to cue up the studio version. This is the one problem, Heidi, I think, when I pull up my songs for the show from iTunes. If I don't label it as the live, I obviously
you accidentally grabbed the wrong one.
That's what I did there, so I apologize for that. Although it's a good version.
Yeah, apologies. Sorry, not sorry.
right. I enjoyed it. I think that was. I think I obtained that from the box set, and they probably sat side by side, and I just didn't differentiate one from the other. Now, the next song, the song that ends side one, is one of those songs that has become so incredibly iconic, and well known and famous that it's hard to even imagine that there was a time before this song existed, and yet. It's also a song that nobody will really ever figure out because it's basically so full of American mythology and impressionistic images, images that seem, so many of them seem biblical, like religious imagery and religious names pop up all over this song. For example, like the first line of the song, I pulled into Nazareth, automatically makes you think, oh, this is going to be a song about Christianity or the song about Jesus. Well, it turns out that, you know, somewhere along the line, songwriter Robbie Robertson said, actually, I was talking about Pennsylvania. Nazareth, Pennsylvania is where they build Martin guitars. And that's what I was talking about. So a lot of the image is basically just how Robertson himself managed to mix up these different things and have them basically seem almost like you would, like the way an impressionistic movie would leave you like, somehow in limbo, not knowing exactly where you are or how to relate to what's exactly happening. And yet when you come away, you feel as though, well, something was definitely going on, but you know, you don't know exactly what it is, do you? The name of the song, of course, is The Wait.
Yeah.
company. Take a load off Fanny. Take a load off Bree. Take a load off Fanny. And you put the load right on me. Followed me and he cut me in the fall. He said, I will fix your rat if you take Jack my dog. I said, wait a minute, Chester, you know I'm a peaceful man. He said, that's okay, boy, won't you feed me when you can?
Yeah, take a load off, Fanny. Take a load.
See what I mean about trying to imagine a time before that existed? I mean, how many times have we heard that song? How many different artists recorded it and had hits with it? That was the original version. That's the first time it was heard. And it's pretty incredible now to think back on it, that being the classic version then, that it was released as the single from the album, and it peaked at number 63 on the pop charts.
Was that all?
That's it. Did not make the top 40. So if we were talking about singles, that would be an alternate choice. The album, however, did a little bit better, as we stated earlier, at rising to number 30. Now we'll go to side two of the album, which starts off with yet another Richard Manuel song. This one is called We Can Talk.
Thanks.
great song that's overlooked from this album, I think, that one.
Yeah, Richard Mandel,
called We Can Talk. There's one track on the album that is, I thought it was a traditional song. I didn't know that there was actually credited songwriters for Long Black Veil, but it is. It's credited to an M.J. Wilkin and a D. Dill. It's an old song, and I don't remember, I mean, since this is 1968, it's pretty early in the scope of things, but I don't remember the song having any real life before this point. But after 1968, this song was covered by a lot of people. Whether I can attribute that all to the fact that the band discovered it and covered it here in 1968, I really can't say. But when I think about all the versions of the songs that I've heard since, this is the oldest of all of the ones that I've heard. So like The Wait, this is another one of those songs that pretty much spread like wildfire once it was out there. And I, like I said, I can't guarantee that this is the first time that it was affected. Obviously, would not have been the first time because the band had heard it somewhere and it was recorded by somebody. So they picked up on it. But I think that this is the one that basically gave it the big push so that it ended up being handled by a great number of artists afterward. As I said, the one song not written by them on this on the album, music from Big Pink, and it's called Long Black Veil.
On a cold, dark night, there was someone killed beneath the town hall light. There were few at the scene, and they all did agree that the man who ran looked a lot like me. The judge said, "Son, what is your alibi? If you were somewhere else, then you won't have to die. I spoke my word, though it meant my life. I had been in the arms of my best friend's wife. She walks me
vocals there by the bass player Rick Danko on Long Black Veil. You know, this is worth bringing up right now because if you were going to ask 100 different people to name, well, who's the voice that you most associate with the band? You know, whose vocal presence do you think of when you think of the band? I would bet you that 9 out of 10 people would say Levon Helm.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
And
but he doesn't really sing all that much on this record.
On this, that's just it. On this record, I mean, Richard Manuel is far and away the lead singer. He sings lead on 7 of the 10 songs. 7 of the 11 songs, excuse me. And Rick Danko takes lead on 3 or 4 of the others. The only time that Levon gets a lead is on The Wait, on one of the verses where they trade it off. But he just doesn't sing much at all on this
because
album.
Because he hadn't risen to the occasion yet.
Right. Now, Robbie Robertson's a songwriter, but he never really sang much. So he's mostly in the background. And on his songs, it's mostly Richard Manuel who's singing, sometimes Danko. But so, you know, Manuel's singing his own songs and Robertson's songs. Danko's singing the cover song and some of Robertson's songs as well. But Levon didn't start singing at this point in time with the band, really. At least not on these songs on this album. That being said, this next track, a Robbie Robertson song sung by Richard Manuel with an amazingly cool organ bit by Garth Hudson. I think this is also one of the most iconic songs on the album. I remember hearing this on the radio a lot back in the late 60s. It's called Chest Fever.
Thank you. So she sits and cries and shakes. It's hard just to watch her. And if I touch her, I'm wondering what to do. She just sits there, hoping for a friend. I don't fit here, but I may have a friend to lend. Maybe I mistook her, but I can't overlook her. Must be someone who can say. Even if she just gets mad, she might be better off that way. And where is all the understanding? Her problems can't be demanding. Why is it she looks my way every time she starts to cry?
Richard Manuel singing his own composition there, Lonesome Susie. Now, the album began with Dylan, and the album closes with Dylan. Closes with two Dylan tracks, actually. The first is a classic song where Dylan shares writing credit with Rick Danko. And the last one, both of these songs, by the way, were songs that appeared on the Basement Tapes, which was already bootlegged and out. And everybody had heard all of these, you know, in one shape or form. Now, when Dylan went to Nashville to record his own album, John Wesley Harding, what's amazing is he didn't take any of these songs with him. He didn't bother. And it's so crazy because both of these songs are incredibly important to his legacy. And some people would say that I Shall Be Released might be the best song about prison ever written. But he left them behind, so when the band released them, they became the first ones to put out an official version of these songs. So here we are then, back to back. We'll let this end the show. Dylan and Danko's This Wheel's on Fire into Dylan's own I Shall Be Released. There it is, folks. Music from Big Pink in its entirety. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back on Friday. Take
care.
Bye-bye.
If your memory serves